I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Many have suggested that this election year is once again the year of the woman. As primaries continue in this midterm cycle, there are nearly 80 women who have already secured a spot on November ballots for Congress and governorships across the country. Today, a conversation with Amy Chozick, a reporter for the New York Times who covered Hillary Clinton, the most famous woman in American politics, in her two attempts to win the White House. Her new book is called Chasing Hillary: 10 years, 2 presidential campaigns, and 1 intact glass ceiling. With more women than ever before jumping into the political fray, in what ways, if at all, is Hillary Clinton a paradigm for women moving forward? Amy Chozick joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome on this Monday to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. The election of Donald Trump has led certain sectors of the punditry to predict a blue wave in the midterm elections this year. Huge numbers of women have entered the political fray, many for the first time and most in the Democratic Party, animated by the chance to provide resistance to the president. So far in this primary season, 78 women have secured places on the ballot in November in congressional elections across the country. That number will likely go up after primaries in California and elsewhere tomorrow. Maryland's primary for governor now includes 2 women, and there are several women contending in congressional races later this month. Several tomes have already been written about the 2016 election, including an explanation of what happened by the losing candidate, Hillary Clinton, whose world tour promoting the book has engendered some criticism, not unlike the criticism she faced during the campaign, and for that matter, all of the years that she has spent in the public eye. There is no shortage of theories to explain why Secretary Clinton was not able to break the glass ceiling of the presidency, even when pitted against a candidate who was as divisive and abhorrent to as many people as Donald Trump was and continues to be. So how do her losses in 2016 and 4 years earlier inform the current crop of women who are storming the barricades in this cycle? Given Clinton's unique place in American politics, in what ways might she present a model for that woman who eventually does break the proverbial glass ceiling of the Oval Office? My guest today knows a lot about Hillary Clinton. She covered then-Senator Clinton in 2008, and she began covering the 2016 Clinton presidential campaign almost 2 years before the candidate even announced she was running, more than 1,200 days before she lost to Mr. Trump. In all, Amy Chozick covered Hillary Clinton for the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times for nearly 10 years. The book she has written about that experience is terrific. She chronicles how that decade affected politics in America and her own life. It is insightful, it is really funny, and it is a revealing look inside the machinations of the press and the political process. It's called Chasing Hillary: 10 Years, 2 Presidential Campaigns, and 1 Intact Glass Ceiling. Amy Chozick joins us on the line from her home in New York with her new son, a 3-month-old whom I'm told is named Cormac. Welcome to you both. How you doing?
Thanks so much for having me. I'm good.
This book is really great. First of all, let me just start by telling you it's beautifully written. You got a blurb on the cover of this from Mary Carr, who's a great memoirist, and I think it is the fact that you are lumped in with the likes of Miss Carr when it comes to memoir writing is fully deserved. I really enjoyed this book.
Thank you.
You write that this is not a work of journalism. This is a memoir. There's a lot about you and your family in this book, as well as Secretary Clinton and the campaign and all that stuff. But I wonder, given the Me Too movement, given the number of women who have jumped into the political game in this cycle, are there ways that Mrs. Clinton's candidacy and in general her entire career will serve as solid paradigms for people who are pursuing office now?
Oh, absolutely. You know, after the election, I remember a colleague, a male political reporter, tweeting something about how after all of that, Hillary Clinton's career will be a footnote in history along with, you know, all the other unsuccessful presidential candidates, but I really disagree. I think as the first woman with a real shot at the presidency, I think that for decades we will study not only her campaigns, but her whole career and how the country perceived her over the years as sort of a, you know, a gauge of how we viewed powerful women. That is not to say that all of Hillary Clinton's problems had to do with gender, but I do think that her arc will be studied for decades as kind of a prism through which we saw ourselves and powerful women in this country.
When it came to Secretary Clinton's decision to either emphasize or distract or de-emphasize the fact that she was a woman candidate, the first major candidate of a political party to run for president as a woman, it seemed like there was some ambivalence, not only on her own part, but on the part of the campaign, certainly in 2016. And you're right that for Hillary Clinton, feminism was always conditional. Talk a little bit about that and her decision to quote-unquote run as a woman.
Yeah, that's interesting. I sort of think of those as two different things, but I think there was so much debate about how much to emphasize gender, and I covered her 2008 campaign as well. And in that campaign, the decision was made that the country was not used to having a woman as a commander-in-chief, and the most important thing was to project the kind of strength of a commander-in-chief and to really downplay gender. You have to project the mettle of a commander-in-chief. And so there were famous memos that leaked out from that campaign saying the country doesn't want to elect the first mama, and that being likable is overrated, being human is overrated. So they really downplayed gender. And of course, when she finally lost to Obama, she gives this pretty remarkable speech about how there's, you know, the cracked ceiling, the 17 million cracks in the glass ceiling, but it still hasn't been shattered. And in that moment, she did embrace gender, and I think engendered a ton of sympathy and respect, and women really liked that. And so she reemerges to run in 2016, and I do think she leaned into the historic nature of her candidacy a lot more. I mean, she talked about, you know, a father should be able to say to his daughter, you can be anything you want to be, even president of the United States. And she talked about it more, but there was still this hesitancy. I mean, I remember during the convention, there was all this debate, and there was a beautiful video. If you remember when Bill Clinton was in the 92 convention, the Man from Hope, the video that showed kind of the arc of his career. And they had a similar one about Hillary and her mother and how she had kind of stood on the shoulders under all of these trailblazing women. And the campaign decided to kill it. They said that, you know, she really needs to reach men and independence, and this isn't the time to play up gender. And so throughout the campaign, there were all of these debates and happening. It was not a simple answer at all. I mean, there was a fear of alienating men, of looking like she's leaning too much into gender. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, and you know, look, she had no roadmap. She was the first one to reach that level. And so there was a ton of negotiating that I don't think they ever figured out.
And you remind us that virtually her entire press corps, the press corps covering her for years during this 2016 seemingly endless political cycle, were female. I mean, this was not the boys on the bus. First of all, you write that there wasn't a bus for a long time. you and the people writing about her were women. And then when she gets to the general election with Donald Trump, it seems that her husband's past infidelities kind of tied her hands when talking about the misogyny of Donald Trump, which had been well documented.
Yeah, I mean, this was, two things. Absolutely. It was this confluence of historic events, historic candidacy in Hillary Clinton, and also a press corps that for the first time was predominantly female. And as I write in the book, and thank you so much for your kind words about it, but you know, by the time I read all of those books, Boys on the Bus and Richard Ben Kramer and all of these great books about the men in the press corps, and by the time it was predominantly female, I think the kind of role of the press corps had been diminished, the traveling press corps. You know, this was a campaign when you could live stream every speech, you could look at Twitter and feel like you knew what everyone was talking about, and so traveling with the candidate, especially a candidate like Hillary, who hardly ever talked to us, made our job feel less significant now that women had reached that part, so that role. So there was that tension. And then to your second question, I think that Donald Trump, you know, a lot of his tweets and a lot of his impulsive comments are taken just as impulse and not strategy, and I think my colleagues are right when they say that. But there was a strategy during the campaign to kind of use Bill Clinton's past as a human shield. I think he and some of the people around him, Roger Stone, knew that that his past might with women might get, you know, brought up. And so, and Hillary's strongest point was her connection to women. And so very early on, they started talking about Bill Clinton's sexual accusers and kind of trying to throw that, try to make that stick to Hillary. And this happened so early that, you know, we sort of thought there's no way this could work. I remember in early 2015 when Roger Stone had a book about all of Bill Clinton's sexual accusers and trying to connect that to Hillary, and we thought, oh, that's so far-fetched. And then you flash forward to those debates when Donald Trump very much used Bill Clinton's history to shield himself from the same kind of accusations. I think after the Access Hollywood video came out, his statement was, Bill Clinton has said worse than that on the golf course to me.
And you remind us that Gloria Steinem weighed in about the seeming reluctance of a number of young women to embrace Hillary Clinton as their candidate. And she asked, where are the boys? The boys are with Bernie. And she's suggesting that many of the girls were going where the boys were. There's Madeleine Albright's famous line that says there's a special place in hell for women who don't support other women. Speaking of the boys who were with Bernie, you were trolled by a number of them throughout your coverage of this campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people were surprised in the book to read about the level of vitriol coming from Bernie's supporters to anyone, really, who either supported Hillary or worked for her, or even those of us who covered her. And the irony, of course, was that Hillary's campaign was mad about my coverage, and Bernie's supporters saw me as being too favorable to Hillary. Or every time you'd write any story about Hillary, why isn't Bernie being covered? There were a lot of very sexist language that I can't even repeat. But it was a steady drumbeat. I mean, I think with the passing of time, there's this perception that all of the negativity on Twitter is coming from the left or the right. But this was the left against the center left. You know, this was the Bernie wing really ganging up on the Hillary wing, and that coming out in a lot of abuse towards female journalists.
Yeah, you were getting it, as you say, from the Clinton campaign, from the Bernie support of the Sanders campaign. But as your former editor Jill Abramson once said, you're either hated or you're irrelevant. So at least you weren't that.
You know? It was very good advice. Yes.
Yeah. And you write right at the beginning of the book that Secretary Clinton about her relationship with you personally and with the press in general through two campaigns. I'd watched Hillary wear her disgust with the whole process, with us, with the campaign, and with losing on her face. Is that really what was going on? I mean, did Hillary Clinton just always and forever, will she always and forever, just assume that the press is against her and that the press is to be, I don't know, feared, but to be dismissed. I mean, it's interesting that there's a kind of ironic equivalence with all of the terrible things that the president is saying about the press and has said it for some years now.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the political, we're talking about the political press. I mean, Hillary, you know, seemed to like her State Department press corps. They never asked her about politics. They usually asked her, I'm not saying never, but they mostly asked her about, you know, foreign policy and kind of substantive matters. And she definitely had a perception, I think, forged very early on in 91, 92, and then into the years, the very tumultuous years in the White House, that the political press corps never gave she and her husband a fair shot. And those kind of scars, she very much brought those into 2016. And I think, you know, you look at some of Bill Clinton's interviews in recent days, and he's still kind of equating the way the press treated impeachment with congressional Republicans. I mean, there's a lot of anger about how the press has covered Hillary. In 2008, she felt like that the media fell in love with Obama and was harder on her. And then in 2016, I mean, she writes in her own book significantly about how she thinks the media focused too much on her emails, held her to a double standard. And so it was really was an impossible relationship, I think, by that point. I think she had, you know, very much went in with, and mind you, a lot of the reporters in her press corps were, you know, in high school or younger when Whitewater was happening. But I do think she came into it very much with these old wounds and this kind of belief that she was not going to get a fair shot.
Amy Chozick is a writer at large for The New York Times. Her new book is called Chasing Hillary, 10 Years, 2 Presidential Campaigns, and 1 Intact Glass Ceiling. We'll take your questions and comments for Amy Chozick when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org, to send us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday here on your NPR news station. Member supported 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, Dr. Sherry Parks joins me for this month's edition of Midday Culture Connections. We're going to talk about Serena Williams and the fact that she was ranked so low going into the French Open following her break from the women's tennis tour to have a baby. She has withdrawn from the French Open because of an injury that just happened today. We'll also talk about a new video game called Active Shooter, in which players can take the role of a school shooter in a school or an office building. It has been pulled from the largest online distributor of video games, but its 21-year-old Russian developer is still considering releasing it. You can imagine how families of victims of school shootings feel about that. So we'll talk about the cultural implications for violence in our society of this game and others like it, again with Dr. Sherry Parks tomorrow right here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest for the hour is Amy Chozick, a campaign reporter for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal in the last two presidential elections, and the author of a terrific new memoir called Chasing Hillary, 10 Years, 2 Presidential Campaigns, and 1 Intact Glass Ceiling. If you have questions or comments for Amy Chozick, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, to send us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR, to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHall WYPR. So, Amy Chozick, you write that you started covering the Hillary Clinton 2016 presidential campaign 649 days before she announced, which ended up being 1,226 days, but who's counting, before she actually lost the election. So that decision changed the way, the decision by the New York Times to put you on the Hillary beat so early really did change the way that the Clinton campaign was covered from that moment through the end of the campaign.
Jill Abramson had a lot of foresight. She'd covered the Clintons for years, and when Hillary left the State Department, it was pretty obvious she was going to run again. And she wasn't being covered, and so Jill put me on the Hillary beat. I mean, something people, I think, outside newspapers maybe don't realize is that, most of the hopefuls, the 2016 hopefuls, if you were talking about Chris Christie or Joe Biden or Rubio or, Ted Cruz, they were all in elected office. And so, you know, the way our beats work is congressional beat reporters were covering the senators who were thinking about running, and the White House reporter was covering the vice president who was thinking about running, and the New Jersey reporter was covering Chris Christie. And so Hillary was falling outside. Here she was, the front runner for the presidency, and she fell sort of outside that beat structure because she wasn't in elected office when she left the State Department. And so, yes, I do think that decision was controversial. Hillary really wanted to, you know, kind of enjoy being under the radar after she left the State Department, did not want the scrutiny of being, you know, seen as a presidential candidate so early. And so very early on, I was, you know, sort of, I'd covered her for the Wall Street Journal and had a good working relationship with her, a lot of her aides when I went into this, and very early on when I was put on the beat, I realized, oh, this is going to be very tense. You know, I realized that they had a lot of hard feelings about this decision. They had a lot of hard feelings about, you know, New York Times stories that long, long predated my arrival at the paper. And so, yes, but it was very toxic very early on because of that early coverage.
And the fact that the Times decided to put a reporter on the Hillary beat led to other news organizations doing the same thing. I mean, they all started, a lot of folks started covering Hillary really early.
Yeah, I mean, she essentially had this core group of press reporters covering her every move very early on. I remember I would go to her. This is when she had a memoir about the State Department that had just come out, and, you know, there'd be a group of us going to all of her book signings and book readings and all over the country, and then the midterms happened, and we'd go to her events for midterm candidates, and so, yes, she was aggressively covered very early on.
And Mike Schmidt, your colleague at the New York Times, broke the story about Secretary Clinton's use of private email server for State Department business. It was 2 weeks after your friend and mentor David Carr died. You had come to the New York Times to cover media companies. You covered the Rupert Murdoch mm-hmm. scandals in New York, or in London, rather. Just 2 weeks after that, and before Secretary Clinton even announced her candidacy, the Times was running with these stories about the email server. And your first reaction, you write, you said that you understood the secretary's instinct not to apologize for such a minor thing. Take us back to that time when she was, you know, being peppered with questions about this and certainly initially very reluctant to even acknowledge it or talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, this was kind of a remarkable confluence of events. You know, here she was carefully laying the groundwork for her next presidential run Mike Schmidt is just a phenomenal reporter who's broken scoops from doping in sports to Donald Trump and Russia, and he had broken this story about her use of a private email server. I think I was naive about kind of the ecosystem of Clinton scandals when I first came onto the beat, and while I think there's a very legitimate story in the leading presidential candidate being under FBI investigation. But I also think I underestimated kind of the storm that would engulf everything else. And that was over the course of the campaign. You just couldn't get any other type of story to really break through. You know, Hillary very reluctantly did press conferences, and it would always be overrun with questions about her emails, which of course made her not want to do these press conferences anymore. And so it was sort of a vicious cycle, I think, in that, you know, to get back to your earlier point, that really just reinforced the kind of defeatist attitude that the press was going to find something, they're going to be out to get me, they'll never let this go, kind of thing. So it was a vicious cycle that sort of kicked off the campaign in a very tense way, right to that first press conference about her emails at the UN.
At the UN, yeah.
Yeah.
And you wrote that, you know, you don't regret that you and everybody else covered the emails, but you regret that it became the only story. And you also placed it on her. You said, you know, Secretary Clinton never really had a strategy to change the conversation. And my reaction to that thought, and I think it's probably absolutely demonstrable that that's the case. But is that her responsibility? I mean, aren't we the ones who decide what we think these candidates should talk about? I mean, aren't we the ones asking the questions? I mean, why do you think newsrooms eventually, you know, had what appeared to be this sort of equivalency between the quote-unquote scandal of the email server on the Clinton side with the hourly, daily scandals that the Trump campaign was dealing with?
I think there was an equivalency. I don't think anyone said, you know, the server and the Access Hollywood thing or whatever scandal it was with Donald Trump. I think part of the problem with the Hillary campaign and the emails was that with Donald Trump, we did a lot of investigations, and you could argue that the investigations happened a little bit too late because the media didn't see, nobody saw Donald Trump coming, you know. And so, but there were so many threads. There was bankruptcies. There was the way he treated employees. There were the way he treated women. There were, you know, dealings with Russia. There were, you know, I could go on about the kind of threads of his tax returns, which the New York Times got and scooped before the campaign, before the election. So there were a lot of threads. And I think with Hillary, there was something about the narrative. It was just emails. You know, if you ask the voter in Ohio who's not following the intricacies of, you know, federal records requests and every kind of minutia, you know, you just heard emails, emails, emails. And I think that was then reinforced when the Russians hacked John Podesta's emails and the WikiLeaks emails came out. And even though that was a completely different story, it just was the emails. You know, I think that that was almost just a single narrative that stuck in a way that, you know, there wasn't kind of a single thing with Trump. There were a lot of different things. And it's not that I would blame the campaign, but I will say that there were a lot of things that would have, you know, either kicked emails off the front page or at least, you know, gotten a different type of story out there that they would always say no to. You know, I counted 47 interview requests that were declined to talk about her national security policy, her economic policy, her work for the Children's Defense Fund. The campaign was understandably in a defensive crouch, but I do think that, you know, it would have been nice to tell readers about those other things, which that's not to say we didn't cover them. It's not like if I didn't get an interview, then I'm not going to cover them. We wrote about all of these things. It's just that, you know, having a candidate give an interview can help elevate a story, and Donald Trump kind of understood that, and it was a shame that they said no to every interview request.
And that was just basically they just didn't trust you or trust the New York Times to stick to the topic.
Her email, her press strategy was to do the Ellen DeGeneres show, and you know, to keep very safe, friendly outlets. You know, I don't think it wasn't like the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal were getting a lot of sit down interviews. You know, this was about a press strategy clearly intended to minimize any kind of tense questions and so that's what, you know, that's what they decided to do.
Yeah. I remember talking to Joy Reid about that at MSNBC. She said that Secretary Clinton would not appear on her program during the primaries or the general, so she was never.
Well, exactly. I talked to Joy about that, too. And, you know, I know that in the aftermath, Hillary has complained that Donald Trump got to call into every cable show. And you know, and I think she's had some legitimate complaints about the way the media salivated over Donald Trump. But at the same time, you know, someone like Joy Reid or anyone else would have welcomed her to call into their shows or come on their shows. So
the other thing that you talk about, and I wonder, did you read John Allen and Amy Parn's book called Shattered?
Yeah, I liked that book.
I did, too. I thought it was a really interesting, you know, sort of TikTok behind the scenes throughout the campaign. They had covered her as Secretary of State. They were with her during the campaign. And one of the points that they make, and it's a point you make as well, is that people fault the Clinton campaign for never coming up with a cogent reason for her to be president. You talk about how she announced for president. She gave a speech on Roosevelt Island, and then she released a video that you compared to a Pottery Barn ad that never really sort of took off. Let's listen to a little bit of that announcement video, Hillary Clinton in the last campaign.
I'm getting ready to do something, too. I'm running for president. Americans have fought their way back from tough economic times, but the deck is still stacked in favor of those at the top. Everyday Americans need a champion, and I want to be that champion. So you can do more than just get by. You can get ahead and stay ahead, because when families are strong, America is strong. So I'm hitting the road to earn your vote, because it's your time, and I hope you'll join me on this journey.
So you compare this, Amy, to the Ted Kennedy Roger Mudd interview back in the 80s when he seemed to be stumped when Mr. Mudd asked Senator Kennedy why he should be president. Is there a parallel comment that goes that Mr. Trump did, in fact, have a compelling reason for him to be president and Mrs. Clinton didn't? I mean, is Make America Great Again enough of a compelling reason? Is that the kind of thing the campaign was looking for? Do you think that's the kind of thing the punditry was looking for from Hillary Clinton at the time?
Well, I think there's no question that Make America Great Again is evocative, and you know kind of what it means. I think you can correctly debate the, you know, what it means, and argue that it's you know, a return to a period that was not as good for a lot of people. But at the same time, you know, I think it is something that you can throw in a trucker hat and understand what it means. And I think Bill Clinton had that when he talked about the forgotten middle class in his 92 campaign, and Barack Obama had that when he talked about hope and change in 2008. And I think, I mean, I devote several pages in the book to the 87 different slogans that Hillary Clinton's campaign tested out, you know, going from everyday Americans need a champion in that video you played. By the way, thank you for bringing back those memories with that video. But, you know, everyday Americans need a champion wasn't quite working, which she knew, and then they tested 87 different slogans. And
yeah, you got 3 pages of them in the book. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it was interesting recording the audiobook, reading all of those slogans. But you know, look, Hillary Clinton would say, I'm not, you know, Bernie had feel the burn, and she was asked, you know, are you jealous of Bernie? I think Jimmy Kimmel asked, are you jealous because he has a better slogan than you? And she said, you know what, I've never been good at slogans. And that's fair, and I think you can argue, well, why should our president have to be good at a slogan? You know, that doesn't impact their governing, but it does impact how you get elected. And I think, you know, having a crisp, clear rationale that you can tell voters that doesn't waver based on who you're running against. It doesn't waver because, oh, now I'm against Bernie and I need to appeal to the left, or now I'm against Trump and I need to win independence. I mean, a clear rationale that carries your candidacy and propels you is absolutely critical. And it's interesting because I partly think of that Ted Kennedy interview because Hillary, in the aftermath of the election, has said that she thought it was sexist that men aren't ever asked to explain why they're running for president. But of course, they certainly are. Most famously, in that interview, when Ted Kennedy was really reduced to incoherence. And so, I think there's no question. I write in the book that Hillary has a core set of principles rooted in her Methodist faith, rooted in a real desire to, you know, help women and girls, and so there's no question. But I think the details had been so negotiated and so kind of debated of, oh, let's not anger the White House, but let's make sure that we represent change, that it just could not kind of spit out an articulate slogan, an articulate message. And I think that was a problem.
And as you mentioned, the whole world thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election, from the White House through most of the press corps, through even the punditry on the right. It was fascinating to have you describe what the New York Times was preparing. Advertisers had already bought space in what was going to be an historic special edition. You spent 3 weeks with your colleagues working on a nut graph for the She Won edition. There was a commemorative women's section that was planned. And then all of a sudden, Trump won, and all of that blew up. It's interesting. You also report that Mr. Clinton, Bill Clinton, had casually even encouraged Donald Trump to run at one time. He thought it would roil the Republicans. And the strategy of the Clinton campaign for a long time was to maximize Trump as the face of the Republican Party. I mean, they were supporters of this idea until they weren't.
Right, exactly. I think there is some kind of revisionist history about taking on Trump. I mean, they certainly, for much of the primaries, wanted to elevate him, wanted the press to take him seriously because they thought it would weaken the rest of the Republican field, which, you know, very late in the primaries, the campaign leadership still thought it was going to be Rubio or Kasich. They just, you know, and I don't begrudge them. I think even the media was very, you know, even the voters in the media and the whole country was very surprised to see the longevity that Trump had in that primary. And so, but there was an effort, there was a strategy to elevate him, to make sure the press took him seriously early on.
And we see how that worked out. Amy Chozick, her new memoir is called Chasing Hillary, 10 Years, 2 Presidential Campaigns, and 1 Intact Glass Ceiling. We'll have more with Amy Chozick after a quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wipr.org to send us a tweet @midday. WYPR. Before we take that break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who've lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. We get their names from Ellen Worthing, who has compiled a list of homicide victims going back 17 years. We also consult the Baltimore Sun's list of homicides and victim identifications that are posted on the Baltimore Police Department's Facebook page. So far in 2018, 116 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, three people were reported by police as victims of homicide. Damon Carlos Baylor was 41 years old. He was the victim of a shooting 22 years ago that left him a quadriplegic. He died in January, and last week, police medical examiners ruled Mr. Baylor's death a homicide. Another male victim was killed last week. He has yet to be identified. And finally, Elizabeth Holland lost her life to violence in Baltimore last week. She was 68 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station, where you're listening to Midday.
Our campaign was never about one person or even one election. It was about the country we love and about building an America that's hopeful, inclusive, and big-hearted. We have seen that our nation is more deeply divided than we thought. But I still believe in America, and I always will. And if you do, then we must accept this result and then look to the future. Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. And we don't just respect that, we cherish it. It also enshrines other things: the rule of law, the principle that we are all equal in rights and dignity, freedom of worship and expression. We respect and cherish these values too, and we must defend them.
Hillary Clinton conceding the election the day after voting took place back in November 2016. If you've just joined us, my guest today is Amy Chozick. 2 weeks after graduating from college in Texas back in 2001, she moved to New York to follow her dream of becoming a journalist. Her first job was as a rover for Condé Nast, which owns magazines like The New Yorker and Vanity Fair. They also own magazines like Allure, Brides, and Self. And for a while, that's where Amy Chozick found herself working. She moved from there to The Wall Street Journal, for whom she covered the 2008 presidential primary between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And in 2011, she was hired to cover media for the New York Times. And 2 years later, long before Hillary Clinton even announced that she was running for president, she was on the Clinton beat. Her memoir is about the nearly 10 years that Hillary Clinton dominated her every waking moment. And it is a gem. It's called Chasing Hillary, 10 Years, Two Presidential Campaigns, and One Intact Glass Ceiling. Amy Chozick joins us on the line from New York. You are welcome to join us as well. 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org, to send us a tweet at midday WYPR. Amy, let's go to the phones here and have you talk to Dave in Baltimore. Dave, welcome to Midday.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Maybe I'm talking about advocacy journalism, but I feel that the Times and maybe YPR enabled Trump to be elected and still does. I'd like to hear some mea culpas, where you guys went wrong enabling the election of this clown.
All right. Well, Amy Chozick, do you think that the New York Times is guilty of the charge of advocacy journalism?
Advocacy on behalf of Donald Trump? That's a
new one.
I guess so. Okay. No, I mean, it's, Look, I think there's been a lot of criticism of the media in the kind of the election of Donald Trump, and I think that, you know, certainly in my book I have some mea culpas about our coverage of the WikiLeaks, you know, some of the things you and I talked about, the email story kind of engulfing everything. But look, I think that 2016 was a confluence of things, and the media landscape had drastically changed. I think there's no question that Donald Trump could not have gotten elected in a different media climate. I think he took advantage of Twitter and live streaming and all of the our short attention spans. And so, you know, sometimes I think that readers think it was the Times' job to get Hillary Clinton elected. And, of course, our job is to best inform voters about their choices. And I think certainly we could all, and not just the Times, look back and see whether we did that and whether we could have done that better. And what I'm particularly thinking about is policy stories, which we wrote but weren't necessarily breaking through or weren't what was, you know, ended up leading cable news or people talking about, you know, on NPR, wherever else. I guess we should think about how policy stories can break through, how, you know, explaining to voters what these different candidates would mean for your daily life, how we can make those stories more compelling and connect, especially when we're in the midst of this storm of scandal. I mean, every day was Trump insulting, you know, a Gold Star family or immigrants, or it was on and on. It was just every day our attention was geared towards the latest. And I think we're still seeing that now. And so the question is kind of the stories that impact people's lives, how do we make sure those break through? And certainly I think we can do some soul searching.
Yeah, and I think you do a really good job of soul searching on several issues in the book. As you say, you're the first to admit a number of mea culpas for things that, you know, could have gone differently and you could have covered differently. When it comes to the Podesta stolen emails,
yeah,
you write in particular how much it hurt to be called an unwitting shill for the Russian government, because here you are with the task of, you know, confirming the emails that were hacked from Mr. Podesta's account and then contextualizing them, which is very
right.
difficult to do. You do keep score. You wrote 1,285 stories on the campaign trail, and for you as yourself, now you weren't the only one covering it, but six of your stories were about the emails. But you said that you know, to be called an unwitting shill for the Russian government, getting their hacked emails out into the public discourse, you said they were right.
Yes,
the Russians, the people who were accusing you.
That's a scene in my book when I'm on my way back to the newsroom after the election, and my colleagues in D.C. had written a very compelling piece that ended up winning a Pulitzer about how the Russians had pulled off the perfect hack to interfere in our democracy. And part of that was these, you know, hacking into these emails, and part of it was turning, and as the story said, turning the political press, including the Times, into unwitting agents of Russian intelligence. So that really stuck with me, and there's been a lot of debate. I'm actually glad to see, after my book has come out, there's been a lot of debate about how we handle these hacks moving forward, because, you know, for all intents and purposes, they'll happen again in the midterms, and I just really wanted to kind of start a conversation about that. Look, I don't know the answer. I think the Times did confirm and contextualize, and we should never hold information that's pertinent to voters. For instance, Hillary Clinton's Wall Street speeches, you know, were in that trove of documents. That's something readers need to know about. And so you don't hide that. But I think it maybe was the unwitting that bothered me, is that we didn't know the extent of Russian interference at the time, and you know, now that we do, what can we do moving forward to make sure we are at least witting participants in this?
And in terms of the amount of coverage that the Russian hacking got, as opposed to how much coverage the Access Hollywood tape got of Mr. Trump, or the coverage of her emails. And as you say, I think people did conflate this whole email thing, one having
right.
to do with the server and the other having to do with the hacks. Just in retrospect, I mean, do you think that the allocation of space and the allocation of effort to the various issues in the campaign were handled correctly?
You know, I cover. I'm from the Wall Street Journal. You've mentioned that I cover her in 2008. I interviewed her extensively on the cusp of a housing crisis and about the impending economic crisis. So I'm very interested in policy. I think most of my colleagues on the politics desk were, and we covered all of those things. I think they, you know, could we do a better job of making sure they resonate? But it's somewhat frustrating because I do get a lot of complaints that you never covered policy, and then I think, but that article I wrote about her tax plan didn't get any clicks. You know, it's like you put these things out, and sometimes they don't. But it's our job to make them compelling and connect, and I think that, you know, The Times is doing a really good job of that right now with the Daily and different podcasts and different ways of kind of going deep on policy issues. But that's certainly something we should do. Continue to do and do more of, and I think it's hard because there's a new salacious kind of jaw dropping scandal or interpersonal battle happening every day.
You're right, and of course we all know that for decades now historians will be parsing and dissecting what happened in this campaign and why things ended up going the way they did. You quote Matthew Dowd, who's a very well-known political strategist and writer, who said that Hillary Clinton had a tanker ship who encountered Somali pirates. So he wasn't up against another tanker ship or an aircraft carrier, but it was sort of death by a thousand cuts by the time she encountered Donald Trump. I mean, in the light of day now, it's been a while. You've written a book. You've had a baby. Your life has gone on since you spent years and years and years on the trail with Mrs. Clinton. Is there one thing about the campaign that sticks out to you that could have gone differently had either the campaign or perhaps even the press done things differently?
Well, I do think it's important to keep in mind that this was an election lost by 90,000 votes spread out across three states. So certainly you say, the campaign ended with $30 million in cash. Certainly you say, well, what if they had spent that $30 million on targeted ads and yard signs in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, So certainly there are things like that. But at the end of the day, I really think, we're in an era when people want easy answers. It was James Comey's letter. It was sexism. It was the Russians. When in reality, there's a thousand reasons why, a campaign is lost. And I was joking that, my version of hell is sitting at a dinner party between one person who says it was James Comey and the other person says she should have gone to Wisconsin. You're like stuck between them arguing. And so I think the nuanced, and I hope what comes across in the book is that there are, a thousand reasons why. Certainly there were campaign problems with her campaign, problems with her as a candidate, but also I do think there was a lot of sexism that I think we're only going to start to get our head around with the benefit of time.
You do write, and even write it up to the end of the book, that you understand Secretary Clinton as having some enmity towards you. You say at one point that our relationship was destined to be an impossible, tortured, and unrelentingly tense relationship, weighted down by old grudges and fresh grievances. Whether or not Hillary Clinton likes Amy Chozick, does that matter when one reads the New York Times and sees your byline?
No, I mean, certainly it doesn't. It doesn't matter. And as you mentioned, the Jill Abramson quote: "You're either hated or you're irrelevant." I mean, in some ways, we're supposed to be, or we're absolutely supposed to have a tense relationship with the people we cover. And so, the book is sort of, you mentioned how personal it is, and this was more of my own kind of getting my head around the fact that this person who I spent all day, every day thinking about, traveling with, following their every move, who probably never thought about me at all, also, really disliked, it wasn't just about me, but about, you mentioned the tension with the press and the tension with the Times. And so you do want some kind of modicum of respect. And I think throughout the book, I struggled with that. And then at the end, really kind of come to terms with the fact that that's, never going to be there, but that's okay.
Well, thanks so much for your time, and thanks so much for this book. One of the things we didn't get to talk about is a neat piece of gossip in which you say that the Secret Service had a phrase that said, wheels up, rings off, which has to do with the various liaisons that may or may not have occurred while everybody was traveling around covering the campaigns. But this is a really, really fun and interesting book to read, so I appreciate it, and congratulations on the new baby.
Well, thank you so much. Really great talking to you. Appreciate it.
Amy Chozick is a writer-at-large for the New York Times. Her new memoir is called Chasing Hillary, 10 Years, 2 Presidential Campaigns, and 1 Intact Glass Ceiling. By the way, on Friday, my guest will be another person who has written about the 2016 election, Jennifer Palmieri. She served in the Obama White House and as Hillary Clinton's communication director in the 2016 campaign. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. We want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. That's it for us today. I'm Tom Hall for the entire Midday team. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.